Welcome to Ira's Everything Bagel, where I talk with fascinating people about everything, their passions, pursuits, and points of view. Well, my guest this week writes about it all, from childhood abuse to Marco the Magnifico, from Pat Boone to Barry Manilow and his destroyed cassette. In her creative nonfiction, Sue Williams Silverman finds meaning in the smallest moments, showing how tiny choices can ripple through our lives, shaping love, home, and the search for who we are. Sue Williams Silverman is an acclaimed author and memoirist, and her latest book is Selected Misdemeanors, Essays at the Mercy of the Reader. It's available on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and all the usual places. And for everything about Sue, go to SueWilliamsSilverman.com, and you can follow her on Facebook and Instagram. And Sue, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me. It's nice to meet you.
I think the most important question is, how do you have both a William and a Silverman in your name?
Well, yes, it's a little bit odd, but so the William is actually my grandfather's first name. And for some weird reason, my parents gave me his name for my middle name instead of like my grandmother's name. So William it is.
All right. I just wanted to bring that out.
Yeah, good question.
You've been writing quite a bit, and this current book, again, is called Selected Misdemeanors, Essays at the Mercy of the Reader. What I like about it, it's somewhat novel from my point of view, is that they're very short pieces, and that's, as I mentioned in my opening, you're grabbing little pieces of life most people would enjoy it when it happens, but not necessarily think to write about it. Or maybe they don't enjoy it, but they don't write about it either. Either way, they're not writing about it. Why did you decide to take that approach?
Yeah, so this is a collection of flash essays, which means that they're short. And it's funny because really I came to it through because of everything I'd written before. So I started out writing long form memoirs, like 250 pages. I've got two of those. And then I wrote two books that are sort of memoir in essay form, which means that the essays are kind of long. And in many ways, I decided to try flash essays because I'd never done it before. You know, as writers, we want to grow, we want to evolve, we want to try new things. And I needed a new challenge. So I thought, I think that I will try to write flash essays and see if I could generate enough of them so that they would hold together as a book. And starting out, I didn't know if I would succeed or not. But again, that's the challenge. So I just went for it. And the book is the end result of it.
Well, I think, though, it's a perfect book for the time because most people's attention spans are short. And I find that even with me, I used to read a lot of books. And I find it's harder and harder to get through a slog of a book, even if I find it interesting.
That's really true. And I think that's true for a lot of people. And there's also, though, a kind of beauty in the shortness. I mean, in terms of this book, I sort of think of it as kind of small moments of beauty, kind of miniature moments of loss, kind of snippets of betrayal, just kind of how much can you show of that in just the essays. There's 71 essays in the whole book, but they range, some of them are about a paragraph, others are maybe about 1500 words or so. So there's a bit of a range, but short, but the part of the challenge was to be able to show those different kind of emotional impact, just in a little small form. But the important thing to note is that even though the form is small, the insight is vast in that it has to have some emotional resonance. Like it wouldn't just be, oh, here's something interesting that happened to me, or here's something funny, or here's something sad, and just kind of tell it as an anecdote. So because it's still literature, I'm still turning my life into art. So even though the form, the outside is small, the inside does have to sort of resonate universally with the reader.
So it's almost a metaphoric emotional haiku.
That is beautiful. In fact, I may steal that. That's how I'm going to start subscribing the book.
Okay, I want to get either an acknowledgement or payment. So acknowledgement is probably cheaper, but okay, however you do it, that's good. So some of your chapter headings are interesting, especially just mentioning things like the Apollo and Pat Boone, as I referenced earlier, and Barry Manilow. And I'm going to ask you to share one or two of those stories with you as we talk, but I wonder, is this, as you called it, flash, is this a new genre or has it been around? I'm just not aware of it, which is entirely possible because I'm very unaware of a lot of things.
It's newer than, so the big sort of memoir craze sort of started around the mid-1990s. Let's say my first book was published in 1997. Flash is newer than that. It's been around for quite a few years, but it didn't kind of initiate with the whole creative nonfiction movement. It was not like the first form that came about. So it's new in that sense.
Yes, because I'm only familiar with Flash Guards and Flash Gordon. So,
yes.
When you write this, I usually will ask a guest who is an author about their writing discipline in the sense of their how they approach writing. In other words, do they donate or do they devote a couple of hours a day? Do they write when they want to? However, but what's interesting about your book, and again, it's called Selected Misdemeanors, Essays at the Mercy of the Reader, is they're flash, so they're short. So it would seem to me that your writing approach for this book would be different from your other books in that when you get the inspiration, you sit down and write right then and there. Am I somewhat near the mark?
Yeah. First of all, what place where maybe it's not quite accurate is I don't sit around waiting for like a flashbulb to go off. I really have to be very focused and I try to write every day, kind of as soon as I wake up in the morning before the email onslaught sort of starts coming at me. And when I first wake up, my brain is kind of fresh and everything. So I do try to set aside that time every day. The nice thing about flash is that, there is sort of more immediate gratification in that, when I'm working on a long memoir, like my second memoir took like 5 years to write. In this, I could, write at least a couple of drafts of some of the essays, in a couple of days or so. And then, of course, I revise everything a lot. But there is sort of more immediate gratification, which is always nice.
Absolutely. You mentioned converting your life into art, and I've heard you talk about that in other venues. But I guess my question to you is, what is it that compels you to turn your life into art as opposed to just living your life?
Because when I just live my life, I don't fully understand it. I just kind of slog along, day to day, things happen. I kind of maybe think about them, but I don't deeply understand them. And only by writing do I fully understand what any given event means. Like, for example, one of the essays is about my older sister and myself. And so growing up, and even now to some extent, she's my older sister. She never really, I think she loves me, but she doesn't know how to show it. So we don't have a close relationship. And so when we were kids, I grew up in the West Indies, and we had this game we would play. We'd walk on our hands, and she always beat me at this game. I mean, we'd go towards a destination. She always beat me, and she would want to play this game with me because she could always beat me. I would play it with her because that was really the only time she paid attention to me. Otherwise, she said, leave me alone, Sue. I'm not interested. Just go away. So that's just like the anecdote of it, so, okay, big deal. But when I was writing it and I was really entering inside that experience and I could envision and feel and watch in my mind's eye my sister walking on her hands, I thought, oh, my sister's upside down. She's my upside down sister, which is to say that the love that she shows me is a kind of upside down love. And I never really fully understood what that meant until I wrote that. And so this upside down sister and the upside down love then becomes a metaphor that the reader can then relate to. And that's how you're turning your life into art. Because chances are you haven't maybe had an older sister where you have had a game walking on your hands to see who could reach the destination first. So maybe you can't relate to the surface story, but almost everybody at some point has had some kind of a relationship that felt a little bit upside down, like the love was kind of off balance and everything. So that's kind of what I mean. So I never would have thought of it that way if I hadn't written it. It's really only writing the actual event, kind of submerging myself into it, where I discover the metaphors. And metaphor is what turns your life into art, because metaphor is what is universal. And that's how we engage our readers, with that universality of our story.
So it sounds like you are using your art both first for self-awareness and understanding, and then two, sharing it with others, readers, so you make a connection with the reader, they make a connection with you, and they may understand something about their lives based on one of those metaphors in the book.
That's exactly it. Yes, that's right. Yeah, I mean, first and foremost, in some ways, I probably do kind of write sort of for myself, because I do want to understand my life. I mean, it's just that, yeah, you know, I can just go through living it and, as I say, sort of slogging through stuff. But that's not kind of who I am. I mean, I really like to think deeply about things and feel deeply. So even if I'm writing about something sad, and writing about my sister is sad, because, you know, I still, even at this day and age, I still want her to really show her love for me. She still really can't. But I also really want to understand it. And by understanding it, it gives it a context. And then, yes, as a writer, then, artists, writers, we want to share our work with an audience.
But sharing your work with things that are somewhat intimate, in a sense, your background as a kid and the abuse by your father, that shaped you. And there are chapters in the book, again, it's called Selected Misdemeanors, Essays at the Mercy of the Reader, that you share it with the readers, but it's an intimate, there are intimate moments that you share. And does that make it uncomfortable for you as a person? For example, you teach, so you're dealing with students, and they may read something in one of your books and have a whole different view of you, because you come across as a nice lady there, and you are a nice lady. But what I'm saying is, you wouldn't expect certain things to be written about, but they are. So I guess what I'm trying to ask, in my long, evolved, complicated way, is how do you mesh those two as a writer, where you're bearing your soul in a way through metaphor, and at the same time, you have to deal with people in the real world who have read you, and I'm sure you get a lot of positive feedback from people, but you also are putting yourself out there for not ridicule per se, but just it's your personal life.
So when I first started writing, I actually did start as a fiction writer, because I was trying to hide behind the truth. But all my, there were bad novels. They're not published. We won't even go there. But I was trying to hide behind fiction because I was scared. But then finally, they weren't working. I just cannot write fiction. So then I switched over to creative nonfiction, and everything fell into place. I heard my voice. Everything was starting to work. And so after I got over trying to, you know, hide behind fiction and writing creative nonfiction, I actually felt a sense of relief. It's like, rather than hold everything inside, it becomes like a pressure cooker. So like I'm holding everything inside. All of a sudden, everything is open. It's out there. This is who I am. You're either going to like me or you're not. You're going to accept my experience or you're not. And way overwhelmingly, it's been positive. And in terms of teaching, and I'm glad you mentioned that. I teach at this low residency program, Vermont College of Fine Arts. And it really helps teach my teaching, because the students can see, oh, Sue had the courage to write about that. Mm-hmm. So, you know, and she survived and she went on and she's still writing and, you know, all of that. So it actually encourages my students to find their own sense of courage, because that's a lot of, not even really just creative nonfiction, but just being an artist takes courage, you know, because you're still putting yourself out there, right? And so in two ways, it's really has helped to kind of just, okay, here I am. This is what's happened to me, you know, and really people are very empathetic and sympathetic towards it, because, you know, that people get to know the real me. And isn't that what it's all about, is sort of sharing the human narrative? You know, that's how we get to know one another. And so I don't have to hide or live anymore behind sort of secrets and lies or anything. It's just out there. And as I say, my students, you know, really, I think, appreciate the fact that that I've had the courage to do it.
Well, it does take courage, because all of us as humans are embarrassed about certain things we've experienced or we've done ourselves, and we don't want it out there in the public. And so, yeah, it requires a certain courage to write about it or to talk about it or both. You know, some people will do it on a podcast, or they'll do it in a book, or they'll do it in a documentary. And I guess that's true. It does relieve you of that. You have no more burdens or no more demons to hide in that.
Right. Like, here I am.
Right. You know? Oh, exactly. I'm wondering if that also helps you. You mentioned your students. Does it help you, or have you learned that you can communicate because of this? You can communicate across generational lines.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. And where I teach, we have students who are traditional age up to like 85 years old. So we have a wide range. And, but, you know, as artists, we all still struggle with the same thing in many ways. And, you know, I just, regardless of, you know, age, background, we're all still just kind of human and slogging along, but trying as writers to make sense of our lives. And, you know, if my students see me still writing, you know, I'm on my, this is my fifth book of creative nonfiction, then it just gives them sort of hope, you know, like, okay, you know, there, I can do this too.
Well, I think that terminology too, creative nonfiction, it's almost an oxymoron in a way, because it is truth. There are facts, but there's also, I'm not going to say embellishment, I'll say artistic interpretation. Would that be fair?
Yeah, well, what it is that, you know, so you have to condense time, right? Like, if I was going to give you a blow by blow, it'd be like a million pages. Something would be a million pages. So we have to condense time. So right there is, you know, makes it creative. But also, creative nonfiction is not a search for a fact that would be like, could hold up in a court of law or something like that. It's a search for emotional truth. And the reader knows that. And they're going to know that we're condensing time, that maybe we're changing names of some people that we interact with. You know, just things like that, just to make it, you know, give it a structure. I mean, life is messy, right? It's just all over the place. So when you are turning your life into art, you have to give it a structure. So with these little pieces of flash essay, you know, there's a lot of other stuff going on around at the same time. But I clear all that messiness away and focus on that moment and what the metaphor might be in that moment. So once you're looking for a metaphor of an experience, that's a creative endeavor, because real life, I don't have metaphors in my real life that I'm aware of. You know, I live close to Lake Michigan. So if I'm taking a walk along the lake, I don't think, oh, the lake is a metaphor for so-and-so. I'm just taking a walk along the lake.
You're actually living life. Yeah. I get you.
And so, you know, that's the beauty of creative nonfiction, is that you can clear away the clutter, the messiness of real life, and give it an artistic structure.
Speaking of metaphor, I have to ask you about Pat Boone. I've had him on my show, and interesting guy. And you have a chapter on him, and it's a metaphor for safety or for father figure, in a sense. Do you want to share a little bit about that story? And then, of course, sure. Yeah, I'm going to probably have to get you to share the Barry Manilow one.
Yeah, sure. So Pat Boone, growing up, I it's not like I had a crush on him, but I wanted him to adopt me.
That wouldn't be a crush then. It would be just an adoption.
Yeah, he had four daughters, and sort of like, okay, I could be the fifth. Would he even notice that kind of thing?
Did you talk to Debbie Boone about this at all?
Yeah, no, I have not.
Okay.
But actually, well, anyway, let me go on with story. So he was really the antithesis of my father. So my father was showed me his love in very inappropriate ways. And Pat Boone was known for being really squeaky clean and very, you know, this perfection of a father. So that was, so Pat Boone really was, is a metaphor for me for this ideal father. So then that was when I was a kid. Then flash forward, you know, many years. And as it turns out, I've happened to read in the newspaper, he's going to be giving a sort of a golden oldies concert, like 15 minutes from my house. So of course I'm so there. So I went to the concert and I've written out a letter and I'd already published my first book about growing up in this unsafe family. So after the concert, I just plunged past security, went backstage, just stalked him, found him. And I said, Pat Boone, growing up, I wanted you to adopt me. And here's why. And I gave him a copy of my first book, which is called, you know, Because I Remember Terror, Father, I Remember You. So it's like pretty dark. And he sort of looked very startled and everything, but he took it and he was very gracious and all that. And then, you know, I started writing about him and published some stuff about him online. And he found out about it and he wrote back to me and he said, you know, I kind of remember meeting you, but sort of vaguely, and I'd really like to talk to you again. And I'm going to be back in Michigan with another concert. Would you come backstage and we can have like a real conversation? So I was like, yeah, sure, I'm there. And so I did. So I went to this other concert, met him backstage. And so I was wearing this little jacket that had like this embroidered flower on it. And he said, you know, at home, I have this photograph of a flower growing up through concrete. And that's what you remind me of, a flower growing up through concrete. So by then he'd read like a couple of my books and he said really nice things about my writing. So he sort of became a fan of mine. And it was just like sort of mind blowing. And then again, fast forward a year or two, and he had this birthday party out in Beverly Hills. He invited me to it, and he invited me to bring copies of my book and everything. And I mean, it was just bizarre, but in some ways, I mean, as it turns out, he did see me more than my own father ever really did. So, yeah, so that's, you know, like you never know. Like when I was a preteen, did I ever think in my wildest dream that I might meet him?
That's coming full circle. There's no doubt about that. And if you have a short one on Barry Manilow, because we have about, 5 minutes left or so.
Yeah, this is much shorter. So I was in a 12-step group for kind of Love Addicts Anonymous. And one of the women in the group she wanted Barry Manilow to be her higher power, which is like, you know, what the heck, you know? So she kept talking about Barry Manilow. And then I had never really listened to him. I started listening to him. Then I sort of got a crush on Barry Manilow. And, you know, it's just
then you became addicted.
Yeah, I sort of did. And then finally, you know, I kind of got over it, but knowing that, okay, this is not how a 12-step group really works. You really can't not have Barry Manilow as a higher power. But that's just sort of.
Well, I referenced in the opening the cassette. So you have to finish the story about the cassette.
Oh, yeah. So I had this cassette I'm playing over and over and over again. Finally, it's like, okay, so you've got to stop this. So I pulled in behind like a McDonald's or something. There was this dumpster and I took the cassette out of the car player and I just kind of broke it apart and I just threw it in the dumpster and that was the end of Barry Manilow.
Well, it's not the end because he's still performing. He's in Las
Vegas. He is. But he was no longer meant to be my higher power
Correct. Well, when you look at all of the different chapters in your book, and as you say, some of them are short, some of them are longer, but they're all nice, biteable pieces.
Yes.
Just take a bite out of it. And is there a favorite one of yours in that long list of topics? So let's look at some of the chapters like childcare on understanding time for the first time. Miss Demeanor considers the time when she was forced to hold the crayon, time travel for beginners, etc. There's all kinds of interesting little title chapters. The Barry Manilow we mentioned, Pat Boone we mentioned, My Russian Heritage, Drinks for All Occasions. And so you really kind of cover the waterfront to use another, I don't know if that's a metaphor, but maybe, yeah, I think it could be. So do you get pleasure when you finally finish writing this and it becomes published and you look at it's between two hard covers as well as digitally available. But the point is, it's an accomplishment. You've finished something. You've taken life, created art, and now you're sharing it with people.
Yeah, there really is. I mean, it's a matter, you know, I think we all on some level or in different ways want to be heard, right? We want people to sort of know us, understand us, hear us. And for me, writing does that. You know, I put my books out into the world and just, and it's not really, it's not an ego thing at all. It's more just, again, it's that human connection. Because like when I get an email from somebody who's read my book and, you know, references either one essay or the whole book or whatever and says, oh, I really, you know, felt what you were feeling. And yes, I understand that. It's like it's being kind of known. And so, and that's empowering for me. So it's empowering for the readers to read about somebody who's had similar experience or had similar feelings about something. So it can be empowering for the reader, but it's also empowering for myself. And then there's that human connection, you know, between the artist, the writer, and the audience or the reader. And it really does mean a lot. Yeah.
Have you changed after writing this particular book at all?
I change in that I evolve kind of emotionally. You know, like now I've written these 71 flash pieces. I've to some extent resolved the issues that I was dealing with in those. So that makes me sort of evolve as a human that I can go on to explore other things or look at other issues. And so, yeah, there's an evolution both as a writer and as a person, you know, as you sort of make your way through one kind of large issue or small issue in your life, there is a resolution to it. You know, it's out there now. It's between those book covers. So I don't have to dwell on it as much. Like I write my obsession. So, okay, that obsession, I kind of understand. Now I'm moving on to the next one. And so, yeah, there's an evolution as a writer and as a person for sure.
Well, that's a great way to leave it. My guest has been Sue Williams-Silverman. She's author of Selected Misdemeanors, Essays at the Mercy of the Reader, available on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, bookshop.org, and all the usual places. And for everything about Sue, go to SueWilliamsSilverman.com and follow her on Facebook and Instagram. And Sue, thanks for being on the show.
Thank you so much for having me. I really enjoyed talking to you.
Same here. And join us every Thursday for a new schmear on Ira's Everything Bagel.